The following KOPN podcast is made possible by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please consider a donation to listener-supported community radio, KOPN. You can donate securely on our website at kopn.org.
Welcome to another issue of Thought Crime Radio on KOPN in Columbia, Missouri. And today we have a guest, Jane Graham, from Oklahoma City. Jane, are you there? Jane, are you there? Can you hear what's going on? Hold on. Jane, are you there?
Uh-huh.
Oh, good. You're on the air now. Okay. All right. We're... One of our phone lines is out for some reason, so I've got you on a different phone line, but it seems to be working okay. This is a show about the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, allegedly carried out by two right-wing conspirators, Terry Nichols and Timothy McVeigh. Timothy McVeigh was... allegedly executed for this. How many people died in this?
Oh, my.
100 and something. There were children. There was a nursery in there.
Yes, yes. There were a number of children, and I'm trying to remember the exact number that he would ask. I started to say 165, but I don't think that's correct. I should really know, having been in it.
Yes. Could you introduce yourself?
Yes. I'm Jane Graham. I'm retired from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. I worked for the government for over 23 years, and I was in the bombing. I was in the Murrow Building at the time of the bombing, and... a couple of weeks before the bombing occurred, I had gone down to the snack bar to have coffee, and there were two ladies sitting adjoining me in another booth, and I overheard their conversation, and one lady was telling the other one that she had talked to a friend of hers who worked with the FBI, and that she, the lady had told her, her friend had told her that they had received a fax stating that there was going to be a bombing of a federal building, and that she'd given this to her supervisor, and he said yes, they were aware of it, you know, and
do you know what department she worked in?
No, she was actually, she was out with the FBI office there. I don't know. I didn't know the lady.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So I couldn't tell you that. But and she was just saying this, her friend was there, and that she had taken the call, and whatever. So I had thought about when I heard this, I was concerned because my granddaughter's mother worked at Balyes, which was in the 50 Penn Place building where the FBI was located, and I was concerned because I thought, oh my God, surely, you know, they're not gonna, nobody's gonna bomb that building with all the commercial and people in that building. And I went home that afternoon and told my husband about it, and said, I said, I just can't believe, but apparently they are well aware and are gonna take steps to take care of everything. So I didn't think that much more about it at that time. And then the Friday, April 14th, I think it was, the Friday before the bombing, I had driven to work and parked down below in a parking spot that was reserved, and I had reserved, and it was right by, it was just to the east of the double doors where you walk, go in on the lower level and get your elevator to go upstairs. And I had a I was going slowly, you know, into the parking space and all, and I saw some men standing just to the west of those doors and behind a green, an older green station wagon. It was just really filthy, and I was watching them because they had plans. They had plans. There were three of them there, and one of the men had plans that looked like from, I don't know whether it was built. At that time, I thought, well, they must have something wrong underneath because we'd had phone problems. We've had periodically had gas problems, you know, maybe the smell of gas. And so I was trying to decide what it was. But, you know, then as I was watching them, and they were watching me, and they were pointing to areas over to the east side of the building and in the north, and one of the men that was standing there had a paper sack, and he had a some line which looked like telephone wire, and they were having a discussion, and I think there was some disagreement about it because there, the one man that was there, he was dressed in, he was about 6 foot, 6 foot one, two, in there. He was dressed all in black, had a black cowboy hat on, had black pants, shirt, black boots, very nice looking man. He walked away, walked to the north side of the garage area there, and was having a cigarette, and the other two were standing there watching me. And of course, I was concerned because, and I said something didn't feel right because the car that they were standing behind, the wagon, was so filthy, and you couldn't make out license plates or anything. But they were parked in a parking place which was reserved, and so you had to have, you know, the normal people came in every day and used those spots, and so I knew they were not in a spot that belonged to them. And so I was watching them, and I just got out of the car and was kind of slow just looking at them, and I saw the one man who appeared to be in charge. The other two men were, like I would say, about 5 foot eight, and they both had on short sleeve shirts, jeans, very, very muscular. Someone had asked me, and I said, well, if I had a choice, I would have said probably military, first surveyor, something like that. But definitely, those were my first three thoughts when I looked at him. And the man that was in charge, he had said something to the other gentleman standing there with him, and he must have told him to take whatever he had and to take it and put it in the car on the seat behind or the door behind the driver's side. And he had a small black a block of what looked like putty, and I thought, well, you know, that's, you know, I didn't know. I thought, well, you know.
You say putty? It looked like some kind of moldable putty material?
Yeah, like a little block of it, you know. And but I didn't really think a whole lot about anything except that he put what all he had back in that paper sack and put it in behind that door. And
was there anything
then
else?
At that point,
did you see lengths of wire or anything like that?
What I saw was what I thought was telephone wire, because it was that color, very light, it's kind of like a beige color. He had some in his hand, and I wasn't that close to, to tell you how much or anything, but he had some, obviously. And but he put it all back into the sack and put it back, and then the other gentleman and he were watching me and very intently as I kind of walked up and looked, and then I thought, well, I'll just go ahead and go. I was kind of running a little late anyway, and I thought, well, I'll mention something later on in the day probably to the GSA, because, usually they know when, like the gas people and telephone people are there, they're aware of, them being in the building. But I had a meeting and some other things going on, and I just I didn't get back to it. And so I didn't think any more about it until the following week. The day before the bombing, the afternoon before the bombing took place, there was a man who was an older gentleman who was walking. He had GSA slacks and pants on and a shirt, and I was downstairs in the lobby area, and he was coming from the west end of the building, and you have to pass in front of the GSA offices and so forth, and he had in his hand what appeared to be, it would have been to me, some kind of a, it's one of those radios or, that you talk into with somebody.
Walkie-talkie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I heard him say, well, now how does this work? And he must have got a response and everything. But when I was looking at him, I thought, well, that's really odd, because, first of all, I thought he's too old to really be. He didn't look the part of a maintenance man. We all of us knew by sight or name the maintenance men who were in the buildings and who came and serviced all of our areas and everything. And this man was an older man, had gray beard, and he was wearing glasses, and a rather nice-looking older man, and he was like 6 foot. 6 months, something in there. And I said, well, I thought, God, this poor guy, if he's in a second job, he's learning a job, it's a little old to start a second career, but, whatever. And then I thought, well, maybe somebody's just off and they've brought him in, to just temporarily, because that happens occasionally where they'll bring someone in from somewhere else and have them stay there. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really think any more about it that day. And went about my business, and the next morning my husband drove me to work and dropped me off in front of the Murrah building, and was going in. I had some mail that had to be mailed. We not only had the post office across the street, but we had a mailbox inside. As you walked in, it was just on the corner behind the elevators there where the stairwell was. And so I had said, I guess, hello to several people there and was just kind of chatting a minute. And then I was going over there to put my mail in the mailbox. And out of the stairwell comes this same gentleman with another man who was in GSA, blue shirt, blue pants and everything. And they came out the door for the stairwell, and I saw him, and I kind of looked at him, and then he just looked straight ahead, and then the other man that was with him, he was a shorter man, very, very bad complexion, kind of scraggly beard all around, and kind of dishwater blonde hair, but he ducked his head down to his chest and looked down, you know, and they just zipped by me quickly, you know, and around the corner like they were in a hurry to get out. And I thought, well, now that doesn't make sense to have two of our GSA employees, maintenance men, out at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, that doesn't seem right. And but again, I thought, not my business really, I guess, but it was odd, and definitely odd. And I went on up to the seventh floor, and I got off the elevator, and one of the ladies that worked there, Trish Nix, was there, and she said, have you seen the bomb squad? And I said, no. I said, why? And she said, well, they had been in the building earlier, and she had seen the truck outside across in the parking lot at the church. And I said, no, I hadn't, you know.
Which truck is that? And would that be the Ryder truck that blew up?
No. This was the bomb squad.
So the bomb squad was there before the explosion?
Yep.
Wow. This is amazing. And
yep, it was. They were there early that morning. And so, you know, I didn't think a lot about it. But then, you know, I mean, I just said, well, you know, because we had periodically bomb threats. And so, you know, it was not an uncommon occurrence. I mean, it didn't happen frequently, but it did happen. And, I had a meeting that morning with... I was also the president and regional vice president of the union. And so I had a meeting that morning to go over the financial part. And I had gone in and was taking care of all of that. And then we had our meeting, and then the other two ladies left. And then the phone rang, and my husband called, and we were talking for a minute. He says, don't forget your, you've got to go to that training. And I said, yeah, I'm on my way now. Well, I stopped. That was just about a little before 9, and I stopped right there as I came out of my union office, which was just to the west of the center of the building. And I stopped and talked to some of the ladies that were in mortgage credit, and there were some gentlemen there. There were a number of people in that little department there. And we were visiting, and I looked up at the clock, and I said, oh, God, I said, I've got to go. I said, I have a Windows session and learning on that, and I wanted to get up to it on the ninth floor. And I said, I need to get to that. And then I had left them, gone to the elevator, and just went up to the ninth floor, because I knew at that point it was just after 9 o'clock and they would have already started. So I got up there, went, got a seat next to one of the ladies there, and everybody, you know, the lady that was teaching the class had already started, and her name was Sheila Schick, and I had told her that, said, you know, I'm sorry I was late, but they had already started. And so it had just been a minute or so, and all of a sudden you felt this waving effect, and it shuddering, and it felt like the building was moving, and she thought it was an earthquake, because the first thing she said was, everybody get down and get underneath your desks. It's an earthquake. And I thought, no, this doesn't feel right. And I just sat there stunned. You know, I wasn't really sure that that's what it was, but I just sat there. Everybody else was getting under the desk, and then it wasn't 8-9 seconds later, and there was this enormous blast. And when that happened, I was thrown from my seat to the center of the kind of the room, and the last thing I remembered, oh, and you could feel the floor underneath me rising.
Okay, so there were two distinct types of movement.
Absolutely.
Here.
There were two.
The first movement was side to side from front to back of the building, for instance?
No, it was from east-west.
How is that oriented? I don't know how the building is oriented. So
it's facing north. The building faces north.
Okay.
And so this was, but the sensation was east-west.
Interesting.
That's the rocking you get, you know.
Okay.
The feeling that, you know, your building is moving.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But the second one came from down within the building. You could actually feel the concrete floors lifting.
Wow.
And the next thing I remember seeing was looking up in the sky. I saw the roof in the sky in midair and debris. After that, I didn't remember a thing. And I had two of my co-workers, Sonia Key was one, and Jeroy McGirt was another gentleman. They came and got stuff off of me that came down and was on top of me and everything. And Sonia kept trying to wake me up and say, finally, you know, I kind of came to. And she said, we've got to get you up and get out of here. And I said, I don't think I can move. And she said, yes, we're getting you out of here right now. So they got me up, got me lifted up, and I started to turn to my right, which was facing north, and I started to walk that way. She said, you can't go that way. And I said, why? She said, because there's nothing left there. But you have to realize that the black smoke was so thick, so heavy, and the smell of sulfur was so bad that I couldn't see literally an inch or two in front of me.
Are you familiar with the smell of cordite? That's commonly, I mean, when you say sulfur, are you sure it was sulfur?
No, but that's the only thing I could ever remember in chemistry smelling that kind of smell like it.
Yeah, because high explosives like plastic explosive apparently smell like cordite, whatever that is.
Okay, well, that could well have been it then, because there was definitely the smell, and I kept thinking, oh, God, you can't, don't breathe this in because, you know, it'd be your lungs, you know. And I was covering my mouth and my nose, but anyway, we had to walk out through, there was a door embedded in the wall, and it was probably at least 3 feet high just into the wall. And after you climbed out over something, you had to climb up on top of that door to get over into the hallway to go down the stairway.
Wow.
Which I did. And then got out of the building. Going down, of course, there was debris in the stairwell and everything. But coming down, the only thing I could think of at that time was those children in the building. And I kept saying, oh, my God, the children, we need to get the children out. And there was a man standing on the floor where the daycare center was, and I said, we need to get in there and get the children. He said, no, they're all being taken care of. You have to get out of the building, go down, get out, go outside and get out, and they're getting you all out of the building. So I didn't realize at the time that the extent of what had happened to the front of the building or to the bombing, you know. And but we did get out, and by that point, we were being pushed over and set out to the corner of Robinson, which is Robinson and Fifth right there, and it runs north-south, and we were shuffled along that way as everybody was getting out, and then behind there, people were being carried out, and there were ambulances and all that kind of stuff, and I thought, oh, God, you know, I've got to call my husband and tell him I'm all right, and then Jeroy had my arm, and I was another lady that was with me, and we got over to the other corner where there was a bank there, and I walked in. I just kind of stumbled inside, and of course everybody was, you know, there with, I mean, people had blood on them, and the windows were all out, all that, and I said, can I use your phone? They said, oh, the phones are all out. So I said, well, okay. So then I went back outside with everybody, and then
this was across the, where was this? This was not.
This was behind the building on the southeast corner.
So this took out, what, the entire neighborhood of telephone lines?
Oh, or? Gosh, there were windows blown out of cars, two blocks.
Oh, okay.
Two blocks from there, and at least and more, you know, I mean, it was just all over the journal record, all over, and the building across the street and so forth. And
did,
so
did you,
I, um, There was a man on the corner that had a cell phone, and I said, could I use your phone? And he said, I can't get anything. All the lines are busy. Everything is down. So my coworker, he said, come on, well, I'll take you ladies home. And I said, no. I said, take me to my son-in-law's. I said, because he's right there on May. And I said, take me down to his office because they have big cranes. And I said, I need to tell him, you know, that they need help. And so I said, you need to get home to your wife so she knows you're all right. So he dropped me off there, and I went in, and Jeff came out, and I told him, and he said, no. I said, can you take your cranes? He said, no, because ours are way too big. They can't use those. And
they probably wouldn't have allowed him inside anyway. It seems as though
nobody was allowed in.
Yeah.
Nobody was allowed in.
I mean, they want tight control over what is seen around these events.
Oh yeah, absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely.
So, did you see any of these suspicious characters hanging around after the explosion?
No, I didn't, because by the time I got my daughter drove down from Edmond to pick me up, and I went to I went home, and all I wanted to do was get into the shower and get all of that, I don't know, all that stuff off of me. And she said, Mom, you really need to go over to Mercy Hospital and have them check you out and everything. And I said, I've got to get a shower. I just can't stand the feeling that's on me. And so I went in and got a shower. By that time, my husband had gotten back home because he didn't know if I was alive or not at that point, and my daughter thought I would have been probably killed because of the normal place that I normally sit, and my regular workspace was gone, and my boss, my supervisor, she was still there, but she just was on a small little area that remained of the floor there, and but she was able to get out of the building as well. And so I really didn't see a lot of any of the people, I mean, other than the people and who were, you know, trying to get out.
Before the explosion, did you have any encounters with any investigators that were trying to look into these GSA people?
No, I did not. I did have one man who identified himself, and I was downstairs actually, and he said, I understand, an FBI man, he said, I understand you saw two maintenance men. Well, when he said maintenance men, I'm thinking elevator people, telephone people, something like that. And so I said, I haven't seen any outside maintenance men, and I just let it go, and I went on my way. And I thought, oh, it's a good thing. You know, afterwards, I went up, only after a long, long time, years after that, I think, my God, was it a good thing I probably said that, or I'd have been dead?
Yes,
I'm sure.
Absolutely, I'm sure, too. Now, this person asked you that, do you know who he was? Where?
No, I have no idea who the man was. I didn't see him again. But I do know that it was sometime, a long time after. I happened to go over to V.C. Lawton's house. We were talking about the bombing and everything. And he was showing a video of you know what, it was on the television, you know, showing a video of the bombing, and on it there were shown two men that were going across across the lawn to the Journal Record. And I said to VZ, I said, stop that. And I said, he said, what? I said, stop that TV. I said, right there. And he said, what? I said, those are the two men I saw, only they were dressed in GSA uniforms.
And where were they? They were on the TV. Were they being interviewed?
No. They were walking. They were walking across together. And one of them had, VZ told me later, it was one of those, like a radio says it had a real long antenna on it.
Okay.
And he said, those are military. He said, those are government or military. And he said, I said, oh.
How did he know that?
I don't know. Well, he had been in the military.
I see.
And
Did they have a demeanor like combat veterans or something like that? I mean, these people.
No.
They were not especially, but that one guy.
That's what I started to say. Now, when I looked at, I didn't know at the time who they were, but I knew I had seen them. Then when I was talking to people about them, and here talking, I did have a lady who was down in Norman, and she was doing investigating and different other people, and then I had someone else call me, and they said, no, they said, the two men that you have identified are maintenance men from the Journal Record Building, and so I said, okay. Well, then there was another man who was also doing investigating, and I had offered my to describe. I had sent a letter to the FBI, to Stephen Jones, to my attorney, and I described all of the men, all of the events that I had seen and taken place, and I said, I'm more than willing to go and look at any pictures that you have trying to identify these men. And I had an appointment. I had one appointment with an FBI agent, special agent, and I waited at my union office for him, and he never kept the appointment, and I called. And I said, I got a hold of him, and I said, is there something wrong? We missed the appointment. You didn't come. And he said, I got busy with something else, and I couldn't come. And I said, well, we'll make it for another time. And we did. That appointment was never kept either. And so, but anyway, they had given me the name of the two men that were the maintenance men at the Journal Record. And but at this point, another investigator had come along, and he was doing a research, and he had asked me if I would look at some pictures for him, and I said, absolutely. And out of those, I had picked out one picture who turned out to be Strassmeyer.
Okay.
And
so
the
saying,
other one...
You're saying Strassmeyer was there at the Murrah Federal?
He was there. No, he was in the building the Friday before, down below in the garage.
And this is allegedly the person running the right-wing Aryan camp in Elohim City.
I heard that he participated in all that. I don't know that for a fact, but
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I can just tell you what I picked out.
Yeah, apparently.
And the other man that I picked out was Gary Hunt, and he is a special agent for the FBI.
Huh.
And I said, light dawns. And of course, then I made that statement, and they said, no, you are totally wrong. They're not the same people.
Well, Strassmeyer turned out to be an FBI informant. He was the man who ran Elohim City himself was an FBI informant. I mean,
yes.
this whole thing reeks of a government operation.
Oh, there's no doubt in my mind. There is no doubt in my mind, after all that was said and done, that this was absolutely something that came down, that was sanctioned, was absolutely planned.
Have you seen a picture of Larry Potts? Do you know who Larry Potts is?
No.
Okay. Well, allegedly Larry Potts was involved in this. I think he was... that's right. Larry Potts was identified by Terry Nichols. Terry Nichols, in his court affidavit, stated that Timothy McVeigh told him that the person running the whole show was a guy named Larry Potts. And it turns out Larry Potts was assistant director for the FBI under counterterrorism. And
Well, that wouldn't surprise me at all, because right before, this is weeks before, Timothy McVeigh had been in our building. He had dressed in, camouflage, you know, military camouflage, pants and shirt and everything. And in fact, one morning when he got in the elevator, there were a number of us in there, and I had made a comment to some of the people that were going upstairs with me and everything. I said, well, we must have a new recruit. He certainly doesn't seem very friendly. I said, he's sure different from, you know, all the other people that normally come in. And I said good morning. He didn't say a word. He just looked straight ahead, got off, you know, where the military normally get off, and on that floor. And then another time when I happened to be there on the elevator with him, and he went to the ninth floor that time, and because HUD had the whole seventh and eighth floors were ours. Mm-hmm. And the ninth floor, it had ATF, and it had some Secret Service people and others.
Alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, right?
Yes, yeah. Yes. And then it really began making sense to me because when I was told, I thought to myself, okay, if I've made a mistake about the two men I've identified, I want to see the two people that they're telling me that I have seen. Because I would admit if I'm wrong. And so I made a point to track down. I went over to the garage behind the building journal record, and I talked to the man there, and I said, do you know where the maintenance men from the journal record have gone now that they closed that building? And they said, yes. He said, yes. He says, they're down on Robinson. You have to go down so many blocks, and their offices was now down there. So I went, and there was another woman that had come in town and was staying with BC. She was a lady who was also doing investigating and reports and so forth, and I asked her if she wanted to go with me, and she said, oh, yeah, she was into all of that. So I got, I went down to the building and asked if they were in. We got upstairs, and I asked, there was a young man there, of course, in the summer, and I said, can you tell me if they're in? And they said, no. He said, the one man was, he said, he's gone out of town. And he said, but the other one is working at, he gave me the name of the building and everything, and I said, okay. But I looked up this one man's name in the phone directory, and there was a listing with that name at Bethany, and I drove out to Bethany, rang the lady's house, and I asked, you know, if her husband was there and whatever. And she said no. And she said he owns a, they do maintenance, cleaning and that kind of stuff, I think, downtown. So I went downtown to look, and I went in the building where his office was, and I saw a picture with his name under it. And I said, well, forget that. This isn't the same person. But anyway, I tracked down, and I got a hold of this, I got where this other gentleman worked at, who was with the journal record and the maintenance, and I made an appointment, and I went over to the building, and I asked for him, and they said, well, he wasn't in. And I said, well, could I leave a message for him? And they said, yes. And I said, she said, well, I can get him on the phone. And I said, fine. I said, would you ask him if I could, I told him who I was and why I wanted to see him, and I said, could you ask him if I could come by in the morning, and we could have coffee, and I could visit with him. And so I made the appointment and came back the next morning, and walked in, and I thought, well, here I go. You know, I walked in to meet him, and I said, oh, thank God. When I saw him, I said, thank God, you're not the man I saw. I said, they're trying to convince you. You are the man that I saw on that television, and there's no way you are anywhere near close to the look of this man.
So who was it that told you that this was the man that you saw?
One was a, she was a news woman from Norman, and she was doing a lot, I think Janice something. I don't remember her name now. And I really tried to stay away from all the newspapers and everything else. But the FBI had told me that I had been mistaken. I even had at one time, and afterwards, I had gone up to, it was Christmas time, I had gone up to Ohio to spend Christmas with my son and his family, and I had a man, and we had gone away, and I had a man who was, it turns out, a friend of Gary Hunt's, come all the way, he had come from Arizona to Texas, down to Dallas, to see a man he knew down there, who was a photographer and so forth, and I had talked to him previously and wanted an introduction to me. Well, he came, he said he was coming up here, so they just stopped by here and see me. Well, I wasn't here, but my daughter and her friend were here, and she opened the door, and they just walked right in, and he just came right over, unplugged my phone, and she said, "Excuse me, you know, what are you doing?" She said, "I want to see some identification." And he showed him some stuff, and he said, "Well, I just want to talk to your mom. I didn't want to make sure anything was being recorded." She said, "I want you out of here. I'm going to call 911. And he said, "Well, you just tell your mother that I'm a friend of Gary Hunt's and that she's identified the wrong person." And so when I got home, I found all of this out, and then I called the man in Dallas who was the photographer, and I asked him, I said, "Who is this man that was with you?" And so he told me, and I found out later that was another person, you know, connected with FBI and all of that kind of thing. And so, I had mail opened for a while and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
All roads seem to lead to the FBI in this.
It was FBI and ATF. If I had to say the other man that was with Gary Hunt, as I said, I never, ever got to identify them or see them in person. There were several attorneys that we talked to on various things, and I told them all. I said, "I'd be more than happy to go down there." I said, "First of all, to me, when you want to talk to somebody or you can have them draw a picture, if you can't, nobody, sure. Well, great, we'll do it, you know. The people down in Oklahoma City are really, we have a really good artist, all that." All of a sudden, I'm going to do it, and then not another word, it just dies, cold. Yeah. Nothing else has ever said anything.
Jane, I need to interrupt for a minute. I need to play a promo here. It's a 30-second
sure.
promo, and then after that, I would like to play the news feeds from the local news channels in Oklahoma City that were playing on the day of the bombing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll be right back.
Symphony Society. The Missouri Symphony invites you to Dueling Fiddles, a free benefit concert by two of the summer's best-known violinists, Chloe Trevor and Felicia Brunel, performing works by Bach, Brahms, Dvorak, and Moszkowski. Dueling Fiddles, Thursday, July 1st at 7:30 at the Missouri Theater Center for the Arts. More information on this free concert is available at 573-875-0600 or at motheater.org.
Okay, we're back. Jane, listeners out there who may not have heard any of this, these interesting bits of information before, just to back up what Jane is saying here, let's review the official story here. The official story is that Timothy McVeigh pulled up in a Ryder truck that was packed with ammonia fertilizer explosives, parked in front of the Murrah Federal Building, and set it off. And allegedly, this was responsible for the, complete collapse of the about a third or one half of the building from the ground level up to the roof. And this is anyone that knows anything about explosives immediately has to wonder whether this could possibly happen with a steel and concrete building. But let's just play some news feeds that were going out on the television stations, local television stations at Oklahoma City on the day of the bombing.
One explosion caused, because here's now what we are starting to learn about the succession, or what someone obviously hoped would be a succession of explosions. The first bomb that was in the federal building did go off. It did the damage that you see right there. The second explosive was found and defused. The third explosive that was found, and they are working on right now as we speak, I understand, both the second and third explosives, if you can imagine this, were larger than the first. So try to imagine two or threefold happening. Mm-hmm. What we've already seen there. It is just incredible to think that there was that much heavy artillery that was somehow moved into the downtown Oklahoma City Federal Building.
Two other explosive devices were found that were not detonated, and they were larger than the first.
I think he said another bomb.
Another bomb. Move back.
Oh, my God, another bomb.
Yeah.
We just saw, if you were watching there was a white pickup truck backing a trailer into the scene here. They're trying to move people out of the way so they can get it in. Appears to be the Oklahoma County Bomb Squad. It's their bomb disposal unit, essentially, is what it is. And it is what they would use to, if the report that we gave you just a few moments ago turns out to be correct, that they have found a second explosive device of some kind inside this building. They'll back that trailer down there, and the bomb squad folks will go in. And they will use that that trailer. You see the bucket on the back there, sort of, this is how they would transport the explosive device away from this populated area to try to do something with it.
The Justice Department is reporting that a second explosive device has been found in the AP Murrah building in downtown Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. Mike, you're still with us, aren't you?
Yes, I am. And I might tell you, in addition to that, that in fact what we were told at the scene a few minutes ago was that in fact two different explosive devices were found in addition to the one that went off.
So a total of three.
Now
confirmed through federal authorities that a second bomb has been found inside that federal building in Oklahoma City. It was an explosion at 9 o'clock this morning that did that damage you're looking at right there, blowing off the entire north face of that building. Again, you're looking at the north face there. A second bomb was found on the east side of that building. A bomb squad is on the scene. That second bomb has not exploded. We don't know quite the status yet if they've managed to defuse it, but it has been confirmed that a second bomb was found on the east side.
The report I have is that one device was deactivated. Apparently there's another device, and obviously whatever did the damage to the Murrah building was a tremendous, very sophisticated explosive device.
So President Clinton just called Governor Frank Keating, and he says that three FBI anti-terrorist teams are en route to Oklahoma City. Right now, they are saying that this is the work of a sophisticated group. This is a very sophisticated device, and it has to have been done by an explosives expert, obviously, with this type of explosion.
The medical teams downtown are unable to get into the wreckage to retrieve more of the injured because of the presence of other bombs in the area.
I just took a look down the street at the Murrah building again. I see another bomb truck going, so apparently they're going to try to get out that third bomb that's been talked about. Still a lot of activity around the Murrah building. Security concerns that another one still might go off.
Fortunately, it didn't, because the second device that they found, we understand, was even more powerful than the first. They then found a third device, and you can see the look on this woman's face and the fear that she might have to go through the same thing again. They then found a third device, which was also larger than the first. Hard to feel lucky at this point, but certainly through some good work by some munitions experts and the explosive-sniffing dogs, further tragedy has almost certainly been averted here.
But it was a great stroke of luck that we actually have got diffused bombs. It's through the bomb material that we'll be able to track down who committed this atrocity.
Yes, he summarized the whole thing right there in that last phrase. With these unexploded bombs, we should be able to determine unambiguously where these bombs came from and, in all likelihood, who planted them. But in fact, no one seems to remember these extra bombs that were the duds that were found in the basement of the building, not parked outside, not in a Ryder truck parked outside, but in fact the high explosives, the plastic explosives that Jane, you apparently saw in the bag being carried by these men in GSA uniforms in the basement.
Yes.
This is we're talking about high treason, mass murder.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's frightening.
It's not frightening. I'm not scared at all. These people
should
be scared.
Oh, no, I'm saying it is nothing in that respect of like being frightened for myself. But what is frightening is the fact that the government can do this, change their stories. Anybody who's even listened to anything, Ben Parton, Brigadier General Ben Parton, I know we've talked numerous times. He was the number one bomb expert for the military for years, and when he wanted to come down, he knew exactly what had happened when he wanted to come down and investigate and see that building, and to do that, he was not allowed to come. He was forbidden to come down there. They cordoned everything off. He was not allowed to come and see it, touch it. In fact, that when they took that building down immediately, they buried that building and everything in it.
Sounds a lot like 9/11, in fact.
Yeah, and then they had a guard, you know, where nobody can get to see it. And then they said, well, General Parton wasn't competent enough to say what had happened on that. And yet he was the one whom they all turned to for other things, but it didn't suit their purpose. And if you remember, and of course this is something I've always said, and that is you have to look at why would anyone want to do that? Well, in Congress at that time, they were trying to get passed, if you remember, they were trying to get passed gun laws, stricter gun laws. They were trying, and it all has to do with power and money.
Clinton was trying to pass his Effective Death Penalty and Anti-Terrorism Act.
And then Janet Reno was right there.
Yes. And this was immediately after Waco, which apparently was a training operation for some kind of special ops or something, because
and the man who headed that for the government was the same one that came to Oklahoma City and was dealing with everything. And interesting enough, all of the people, whether it been police, political positions, every one of the people who supported what came down from Washington have all found favorable positions, more money, more authority.
Isn't that interesting? The same thing happened in 9/11 with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, who should have been fired after this fiasco of NORAD collapsing under the weight of razor blades, and people in caves in Afghanistan took down a $1 trillion defense network.
Yeah.
I mean, this is ridiculous. People should
be outraged. Unfortunately, I don't know what has happened in this country. I really, really have just been so concerned for this country, because it appears that, as long as the government endorses it, as long as they're willing to deny, and I think it was a matter of denial for a number of reasons with ATF and FBI, because if they admitted to it, then they were liable for the lawsuits that were involved.
Yes, but
they were liable.
Where's the media been in all this? How did this happen with the media? We're supposed to have a free press, right?
wrong. You don't have a free press anymore.
No.
In fact, every day, more and more freedoms are being taken. And the people are allowed. I wonder how long it's going to take the average person in this country to wake up and say, enough is enough. We have to take our country back.
Well, we're like the frog in the frying pan. The heat is being increased slowly, and people are saying, it's not that bad yet,
Well, it's amazing. Even within my own, the people who worked for HUD, I tried to tell them all of this, and they said, our government wouldn't do anything like that.
Oh,
wow,
no.
That's a terrible thing to say. I said, what do you mean terrible? I said, reality. You better wake up.
Really?
Have you
heard any interviews with David Paul Hammer? Do you know who David Paul Hammer is?
No.
He was he was on death row with Timothy McVeigh.
Oh, uh-huh.
Yeah, he's still alive and giving interviews, actually. And if you...
No, I don't know him, but I know this, that VZ and I filed a lawsuit. I called him and asked him if he would file with me. We filed a lawsuit to stay the execution of Timothy McVeigh, as a material witness.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, and that was another thing. I offered my testimony to the grand jury here in Oklahoma City, and Macy, who was the district attorney, sent me back a letter and told me that the grand jury was not interested in anything that I had to say to them.
Well,
and,
here's what David Paul Hammer said. He, you know, talked with Timothy McVeigh in their cells for years
uh-huh.
before Timothy McVeigh was allegedly executed. And I say allegedly, I'll get to that in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
David Paul Hammer said in interviews that Timothy McVeigh told him that he was part of a special ops military operation. He was actually an intelligence, military
mm-hmm.
intelligence. That's where he was recruited. From the military, and he was told to drop out and act like he'd, you know, dropped out of the military and become a drifter. And he was told that in the that the purpose of this operation was to draw you know, public scorn on the militia movement that had arisen
yeah.
in response to Waco. And he was he told him David Paul Hammer that this was the whole thing was a government operation, and that he was had been told that he would not in fact be executed, that they would simulate his execution, they
yes.
would give him drugs to make him appear to be dead. But
I do believe that.
Yes, and two witnesses, two newspaper reporters that were at the execution chamber, reported that when McVeigh was wheeled out of the chamber, he was still breathing.
Well, yeah, I believe that too, because the normal man that normally I had heard that the man that normally did the execution and the you know, the intravenous and all of that, he was replaced, and another man administered that, and I fully believe that McVeigh worked for the military. I think it was a special ops deal. I think it was one that was military precision and being carried out.
Yeah.
And what better way than to kill innocent people and children to get your mind and your focus off of what was going on by, you know, in the meantime, with taking away people's rights.
Yes, all in the name of our protection from the very people that are causing all this trouble.
Absolutely.
You know, 9/11. This is just a presage to what happened on 9/11.
Well, and it's
the,
you know,
the facade is collapsing around these people's ears, and they probably are feeling cornered, and they should feel scared about the people finding out about this, because these people are going to, you know, at some point they're going to face justice. And I don't know exactly how that's going to happen, but they're definitely going to face justice. And I think they should be sweating at this point. But it's getting close to the end of the hour, and the next show is waiting in the wings here, the Tech Guys.
Okay, well, thank you so much for talking with me. I appreciate it, and I appreciate you having me on your radio show.
Thank you so much for your courage. Your courage is all too rare in this society.
Well, I tell you, somebody's got to stand up, and hopefully enough people out there are going to have just enough of every single party that is, I'm not saying Democrats, I'm saying Democrats, Republicans, everybody who's in Congress and a part of this nonsense. We need to go back to our original foundation of what this country was founded upon, and by God principles, and get over, you know,
Yeah, we have a constitution in this country. We already have the rule of law. It's just a matter of somebody paying attention to what it is.
Yeah, well, they're trying to take it away.
Yes, they are, but they're not going to succeed.
I hope not.
They're going to go down in flames. Yeah. So, anyone interested out there who actually has the nerve to get out there and do some research on their own into this thing, should research the phrase David Paul Hammer. He wrote a book about his conversations with Timothy McVeigh. And if they want to find the video that I just played, the local TV news feeds, they just need to go to video.google.com and search for OKC bombing rare, and the first hit will hit on this video. And if they want to find out about the World Trade Center bombing in '93, they can search for WTC bombing rare, and have Dan Rather tell them how. the person who supplied the explosives in 1993 for the explosion in the basement of the World Trade Center was an FBI informant. So there's a pattern here, people. And, you know, this is not a time for fear. This is a time for anger.